T. Lobsang Rampa. As it was. It is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. Foreword. All the best books have a foreword, so it is very necessary that this book have one. After all, authors are quite entitled to regard their own books as the best. Let me start the best with an explanation of why I chose my title. As it was. Now why would he use such a silly title? He says in other books that he always writes the truth. Sure, sure, you shall have your explanation, so just keep calm, should be in 6-inch capitals, and read on. All my books are true, and I have maintained that fact in face of relentless persecution and calumny. But throughout the ages, sane, sensible people have been persecuted and even tortured and killed for telling it as it was. A very wise man was almost burnt at the stake for daring to assert that the earth revolved around the sun instead of as the priests taught that the earth was the center of creation and all planets revolved around it. The poor fellow had a terrible time, being stretched on the rack and all that, and saved being cooked only by recanting. Then there have been people who inadvertently levitated at the wrong moment in front of the wrong people with the wrong results. They have been bumped off in various spectacular ways for letting it be known that they were different from the common horde. Some of the horde are common, too, especially if they are pressmen. Humans of the worst type, you know who they are. Just love to drag everyone down to the same level, they just cannot bear to that anyone is different from they, so, like maniacs, they cry destroy. Destroy. And instead of trying to prove a person right, they must always try to prove him wrong. The press in particular like to start witch hunting and persecute a person so that sensation may be stirred up. The morons of the press lack the wits to think that there might be something in it after all. Edward Davis, America's toughest cop, wrote in True magazine dated January 1975. The media in general one is really composed of a bunch of frustrated fiction writers. Putting it another way, journalism is filled with Picasso types who get out their paint boxes and construct a picture that's supposed to be me, but which nobody recognizes except the guy with the dark brush and feathers. Mr. Davis, it is very clear, does not like the press. Nor do I. Both of us have good reason not to. A pressman said to me. Truth? Truth never sold a paper. Sensation does. We do not bother with truth, we sell sensation. Ever since the publication of the Third Eye True book, strange creatures have crawled out of the woodwork and with pens dipped in venom have written books and articles attacking me. Self-styled experts declared this to be false, while others of the genre declared this to be true but that false. No two experts could agree. Itinerant investigators toured around interviewing people who had never met me, fabricating wholly imaginary stories. The investigators never met me either. Pressmen, desperate for sensation, concocted interviews which never took place. Mrs. Rampa, in an entirely fabricated interview, was misquoted as saying the book was fiction. She did not say it. She has never said it. We both say, pal, my books are true. But neither press, radio, or publishers have ever permitted me the opportunity of giving my side of the matter. Never. Nor have I been asked to appear on TV or radio and tell the truth. Like many before me, I have been persecuted for being different from the majority. So humanity destroys those who could help mankind with special knowledge or special experiences. We, the unusual, could, if allowed, push back the frontiers of knowledge and advance man's understanding of man. The press reports me as small and hairy, big and bald, tall and short, thin and fat. Also, according to reliable press reports, I am English, Russian, a German sent to Tibet by Hitler, Indian, etc. Reliable press reports. Anything, anything at all except the truth, but that is contained within my books. So many lies have been told about me. So much distorted imagination has been exercised, so much suffering has been caused, so much misery. But here in this book is truth. I am telling it as it was. Book 1 as it was in the beginning, Chapter 1. The old man leaned back wearily against a supporting pillar. His back was numb with the pain of sitting long hours in one cramped position. His eyes were blurred with the rheum of age. Slowly he rubbed his eyes with the back of his hands and peered around. Papers, papers, nothing but papers littered the table before him. Papers covered with strange symbols and masses of crabbed figures. Dimly seen people moved before him awaiting his orders. Slowly the old man climbed to his feet, fretfully thrusting aside helping hands. Shaking with the weight of years, he moved to a nearby window. Shivering a little by the opening, he tucked his ancient robe tighter around his sparse frame. Bracing his elbows against the stonework, he stared around. Cursed with the ability to see afar when his work demanded that he see near, he now could see to the farthest limits of the plain of Lhasa. The day was warm for Lhasa. The willow trees were at their best, with leaves showing the youngest green. Small catkins, or pussy willow, lent a pleasant myriad of yellow streaks to the green and brown background. 400 feet below the old man, the colors blended most harmoniously with the gleam of the pellucid water showing through the lower branches. The old chief astrologer mused on the land before him, contemplated the mighty Potala in which he lived and which he so rarely left, and then only for the most pressing matters. No, no, he thought, let me not think of that yet, let me rest my eyes by enjoying the view. There was much activity in the village of Sho, which clustered so snugly at the foot of the Potala. Brigands had been caught while robbing traders in the high mountain passes and had been brought to the Hall of Justice in the village. Justice had already been dispensed to other offenders. Men convicted of some serious crime or other walked away from the hall, their chains clanking in tune with their steps. Now they would have to wander from place to place begging for their food, for, chained, they could not easily work. The old astrologer gazed wistfully toward the great cathedral of Lhasa. Long had he contemplated a visit to renew boyhood memories. His official duties had for too many years prevented any diversions for pleasure alone. Sighing, he started to turn away from the window, and then he stopped and looked hard into the distance. Beckoning to an attendant, he said, coming along the Dogpullinga, just by the Caesar, I seem to recognize that boy, isn't it the Rampa boy? The attendant nodded yes, reverend sir, that is the Rampa boy and the manservant Sue, the boy whose future you are preparing in that horoscope. The old astrologer smiled wryly as he looked down on the figure of the very small boy and the immense, almost 7-foot-tall manservant from the province of Kham. He watched as the two ill-matched figures, one on a small pony and the other on a large horse, rode up until an outcrop of rock from the mountain hid them from view. Nodding to himself, he turned back to the littered table. So this, he murmured, will be square with that. HMMN. So for more than 60 years he will have much suffering because of the adverse influence of his voice lapsed into a low drone as he rifled through countless papers, making notes here, and scratching out there. This old man was the most famous astrologer of Tibet, a man well versed in the mysteries of that venerable art. The astrology of Tibet is far different from that of the West. Here in Lhasa the date of conception was correlated with the date of birth. A progressed horoscope also would be done for the date on which the complete work was to be delivered. The chief astrologer would predict the life path of the famous, and of significant members of those families. The government itself would be advised by astrologers, as would the Dalai Lama. But this was not the astrology of the West, which seems to be prostituted to the sensational press. At long, low tables, priest astrologers sat cross-legged checking figures and their relationship to each other. Charts were drawn of the heavenly configurations extant at the time of conception, time of birth, time of delivery of the horoscope reading, which was known well in advance, and for every year of the life of the subject a full chart and annual delineation was prepared. Then there was the blending of the whole into one very large report. Tibetan paper is all handmade and forms quite thick, held in a pile between two sheets of wood. In the West, sheets roughly 8 inches from top to bottom by about 2 feet to 2 feet 6 broad. Western paper for writing is longer from top to bottom than it is broad. Tibetan paper is the opposite. The pages of books are not bound, but as such books would soon be ruined, with pages lost or torn. In Tibet, paper is sacred and is treated with extreme care, To waste paper is a serious offense, and to tear a page was to waste paper, hence the extreme care. A lama would be reading, but he would have a small acolyte to stand by him. The wooden top sheet of the book would be removed with great care and would be placed face down on the left of the reader. Then, after reading the top sheet, the page would reverently be removed by the acolyte and placed face down on the top cover. After the reading was finished, the sheets would be carefully leveled, and the book would be tied together with tapes. So was the horoscope prepared. Sheet after sheet was written on or drawn upon. The sheet was put aside to dry, for it was an offense to waste paper by smudging. Then, at last, after perhaps 6 months, for time did not matter, the horoscope was ready. Slowly the acolyte, in this case a young monk with already several years of experience, reverently lifted the sheet and placed it face down upon its companion on the leaf. The old astrologer lifted the new sheet thus exposed. "TCH, TCH," he grumbled, "this ink is going a bad color before it is even exposed to the light. We must have this page written." With that he picked up one of his scribble sticks and made a hasty notation. These scribble sticks were an invention dating back many thousands of years, but they were made in precisely the same manner as they had been made 2 or 3 thousand years before. There was, in fact, a legend to the effect that Tibet had once been by the side of a shining sea, and support was lent to the legend by the frequent finding of seashells, fossilized fish, and many other items which could have come only from a warmer country than beside the sea. There were buried artifacts of a long-dead race, tools, carvings, jewelry. All these, together with gold, could be found in great profusion by the side of the rivers that ran through the country. But now the scribble sticks were made in exactly the same way as they had been made previously. A large mass of clay was obtained, and then monks sallied forth and picked from willow trees suitable saplings, thin pieces of twig about half as thick as one's little finger and perhaps a foot long. These were very carefully gathered and then were taken back to a special department of the Potala. Here all the twigs would be carefully examined and graded. The straight flawless ones would have particular care devoted to them. They would be peeled and then wrapped in clay, much caution being exercised to ensure that the twigs were not bent. Those twigs which had a slight bend or twist were also wrapped in clay, because they would be suitable for junior monks and acolytes to use in their own writings. The bundles of clay, each with a seal impression showing which was superclass, for the highest lamas and the inmost one himself, and then first class for high class lamas, and second class for ordinary use, would have a very small hole made through the clay so that steam generated during a heating process could escape and thus obviate the bursting of the clay wrapping. Now the clay would be laid on racks in a large chamber. For a month or so they would just lie there with the moisture evaporating in the low humidity atmosphere. Sometime between 4 to 6 months later the clay bundles would be removed and transferred to a fire. The fire would also be used for cooking purposes, heating water, and things like that, and carefully placed so that they were right in the reddest part of the fire. For a day the temperature would be maintained, and then that fire would be permitted to die out. When it was cold the clay bundles would be broken open, the waste clay thrown away, and the carbonized willow sticks, charcoal, would now be ready for the highest use, which is the dissemination of true knowledge. The willow sticks which had been determined as unsuitable for conversion into charcoal sticks would have been used to help the fires drying out the clay of the better sticks. The fires were of well-dried yak dung and any odd wood which happened to be around. But again, wood was never used for burning if it could be of use for some other more noble purpose, because wood was in very short supply in Tibet. Scribble sticks, then, were that commodity which in the Western world are known as charcoal sticks, and which are used by artists in their black and white drawings. But ink also was required in Tibet, and for that another sort of wood was used, again wrapped in clay. This was heated much longer and subjected to a much higher temperature. Then, after several days when the fires were extinguished and the clay balls raked from the now cold firebed and broken open, a very black residue would be found inside, almost pure carbon. The carbon would be taken and very, very carefully examined for anything which was not black carbon. Then it would be put in a piece of fairly coarse mesh cloth which would be tightened and tightened over a piece of stone which had a depression in it, which had, in effect, a trough in it. The trough would be possibly 18 inches by 12 inches and perhaps 2 inches deep. Monks of the domestic class would pummel the cloth in the bottom of the trough so that gradually a very fine carbon dust was formed. Eventually that would be mixed with a hot gum from certain trees which grew in the area. It would be stirred and stirred and stirred until the result was a black gooey mass. Then it would be allowed to dry in cakes afterwards. When one wanted ink, one just rubbed one of these cakes in a special stone container and a little water would be added to it. The result would be an ink which was of a rusty brown color. Official documents and the highly important Astrologica 1 charts were never prepared from ink of this common base. Instead, there was a piece of very highly polished marble which was suspended at an angle of about 45 degrees, and below it there would be perhaps a dozen butter lamps sputtering away. The wicks would be made too long, too high, so that the lamps gave off a thick black smoke. The smoke would hit the polished marble and would immediately condense into a black mass. Eventually, when a suitable thickness had built up, a young monk would tip the plate of marble and scoop off all the accumulation of lamp black before restoring the plate to its 45-degree angle so that more carbon could be collected. From trees a resinous gum would be collected and would be put in a container which would be very thoroughly heated so that the gum acquired the consistency of water and became much clarified. From the top of the gum, merrily boiling and seething away, a thick residue of scum would be scraped, leaving an absolutely clear, slightly yellow, liquid. Into that would be stirred a whole mass of lamp black until the result was a fairly stiff paste. Then the stuff would be ladled out and spread on stone to cool and solidify. For the highest lamas and officials, the lumps would be cut into rectangles and made into a fairly presentable mass, but the lower echelon of monks were glad to get any shape of ink slab. This was used as was the first type, that is, a special piece of stone with a recess, or small trough, was used, and into it was scraped some of the small block of ink. Then it was mixed with water until a suitable consistency was obtained. There were, of course, no steel pens in Tibet, no fountain pens, no ball pens. Instead, willow twigs were used which had been carefully skinned and made smooth and the ends slightly fluffed so that, in effect, they were like brushes with very, very short bristles. The sticks were then carefully dried, very carefully indeed, to avoid cracking or warping, and then when they were dry enough to prevent splitting, they were put on hot stone which had the effect of fire hardening them so that they could be handled with impunity and so that they would last quite a long time. Tibetan writing, then, is more Tibetan brushing because the characters, the ideographs, are written with a brush form in somewhat the same way as Chinese or Japanese people write. But the old astrologer was muttering away about the poor quality of ink on a page. He continued reading, and then found that he was reading about the death of the subject of the horoscope. Tibetan astrology covers all aspects, life, living, death. Carefully he went through his predictions, checking and rechecking, because this was a prediction for the member of a very important family. A prediction for a person who was important not merely because of his family connections but important in his own right because of the task allotted to him. The old man sat back, his bones creaking with wren nests. With a shudder of apprehension he recalled that his own death was precariously near. This was his last great task. The preparation of a horoscope is such detail as he had never done before. The conclusion of this task and the successful declaiming of his reading would result in the loosening of the bonds of the flesh, and the early termination of his own life. He wasn't afraid of death. Death was merely a period of transition as he knew, but transition or no transition, it was still a period of change, change which the old man loathed and feared. He would have to leave his beloved Potala, he would have to vacate his coveted position of chief astrologer of Tibet. He would have to leave all the things that he knew, all the things which were dear to him. He would have to leave and, like a new boy at a lamasery, he would have to start again. When? He knew that. Where? He knew that too. But it was hard leaving old friends, it was hard making a change life, because there is no death. That which we call one death is merely transition from life to life. He thought of the processes. He saw himself as he had seen others so often dead. The immobile body no longer able to move, no longer a sentient creature, but just a mass of dead flesh supported by a mass of dead bones. In his imagination he saw himself thus, being stripped of his robes and bundled up with his head touching his knees and his legs bent behind. In his mind's eye he saw himself being bundled on the back of a pony, wrapped in cloth, and taken away beyond the outskirts of the city of Lhasa, where he would be given into the care of the disposers of the dead. They would take his body and they would place it on a big flat rock, specially prepared for that purpose. He would be split open and all his organs would be taken out. The chief of the disposers would call aloud into the air and down would come swooping a whole flock of vultures. Well accustomed to such things, the chief disposer would take the heart and throw it toward the chief vulture, who would gulp it down without much ado. Then the kidneys, the lungs, and other organs would be cut up and thrown to the other vultures. With blood-stained hands the disposers would rip off the flesh from the white bones, would cut the flesh into strips and throw them too to the vultures, who were clustered around like a solemn congregation of old men at a party. With all the flesh stripped off and all the organs disposed of, the bones would be broken into small lengths and then would be pushed into holes in the rock. Then rods of rock would pound the bones until they became just a powder. The powder would be mixed with the blood from the body and with other body secretions and left on the rocks for the birds to eat. Soon, in a matter of a few hours, there would be no trace of that which had once been a man. No trace of the vultures either. They would have gone away somewhere until called for their grisly service on the next occasion. The old man thought of all this, thought of the things he had seen in India, where poor people were disposed of by throwing the weighted bodies into the rivers or by burying them in the earth, but the richer people who could afford wood would have their bodies burned until only the flaky ash remained, and then this would be thrown into some sacred river so that the ash, and perhaps the spirit of the person, would be called back to the bosom of Mother Earth. He shook himself roughly and muttered, "This is no time to think of my transition. Let me finish my task while I prepare the notes on the transition of this small boy." But it was not to be. There came an interruption. The old astrologer was murmuring instructions for the whole page to be rewritten in better ink when there came the sound of hasty footfalls, and the slamming of a door. The old man looked up fretfully. He wasn't used to having interruptions of this kind. He wasn't used to having noise in the astrological department. This was an area of calm, of quietude, of contemplation, where the loudest sound was the scraping of a fire-hardened twig across the rough surface of handmade paper. There came the sound of raised voices. "I must see him, I must see him this instant," the inmost one demands. Then there came the slap-slap of feet upon the ground, and the rustle of stiff cloth. A lama of the Dalai Lama's household appeared, clutching in his right hand a stick in a cleft of which, at the distal end, a piece of paper was seen to bear the writing of the inmost one himself. The lama came forward, made a customary half bow to the old astrologer, and inclined the stick in his direction so that he could remove the written missive. He did so, and frowned in dismay. But he muttered, "How can I go now? I am in the midst of these calculations, I'm in the midst of these computations. If I have to stop at this instant." But then he realized that there was nothing for it but to go on the instant. With a sigh of resignation he changed his old work robe for a tidier one, picked up some charts and a few scribble sticks, and turned to a monk beside him saying, "Here, boy, carry these and accompany me." Turning he walked slowly out of the room in the wake of the golden-robed lama. The golden-robed lama moderated his step so that the aged one following him should not be unduly distressed. For long they traversed endless corridors. Monks and lamas scurrying about their business stood respectfully aside with heads bowed as the chief astrologer went by them. After a considerable walk and mounting from floor to floor, the golden-robed lama and the chief astrologer reached the topmost floor, wherein were the apartments of the Dalai Lama himself, the 13th Dalai Lama, the inmost one, the one who was to do more for Tibet than any other Dalai Lama. The two men turned a corner and encountered three young monks behaving in an apparently riotous manner. They were skating about with their feet wrapped in cloth. Respectfully they ceased their gambols and stood aside as the two men passed. These young men had a full-time job, there were many floors to be kept spotlessly polished, and the three young monks spent the whole of their working hours with heavy cloths around their feet. They walked and ran and slid across the vast areas of flooring, and as a result of their efforts the floor had a wondrous gleam together with the patina of antiquity. But the floor was slippery. Considerately the golden-robed lama stepped back and took the arm of the old astrologer, knowing full well that a broken leg or a broken arm at his age would be virtual sentence of death. Soon they came to a large sunny room in which the great 13th himself was sitting in the lotus position, gazing out through a window at the panorama of Himalayan mountain ranges stretching before him and, in fact, all around the valley of Lhasa. The old astrologer made his prostrations to the god king of Tibet. The Dalai Lama motioned for the attendants to leave, and soon he and the chief astrologer were alone sitting face to face on the seat cushions used in Tibet in place of chairs. These were old acquaintances, well versed to the ways each of the other. The chief astrologer knew all the affairs of state, knew all the predictions about Tibet, for he, indeed, had made most of them. Now the great 13th was looking most serious because these were momentous days, days of stress, days of worry. The East India Company, a British company, was trying to get gold and other items out of the country, and various agents and leaders of British military might were toying with the idea of invading Tibet and taking over that country, but the threat of Russia in the near background prevented that drastic step being taken. It will suffice to say, though, that the British caused much turmoil and much trouble for Tibet at that stage, just as in much later years the Chinese communists would do. So far as the Tibetans were concerned, there was little to choose between the Chinese and the British. The Tibetans merely wanted to be left alone. Unfortunately, there was another more serious problem in that in Tibet at that time there were two sets of priests, one was known as the Yellow Caps and the other was known as the Red Caps. Sometimes there were violent disputes between them, and the two leaders, the Dalai Lama who was the head of the Yellow Caps, and the Panchen Lama who was the head of the Red Caps, had no love whatever for each other. Really there was little sympathy between the two sects. The Dalai Lama's supporters at the time had the upper hand, but it had not always been so. At other times the Panchen Lama who was soon to be forced to leave Tibet had been in the forefront, and then the country had been plunged into chaos until the Dalai Lama had been able to reinforce his claims with the aid of the Tatars, and because on religious grounds the Yellow Caps had what one might term superior sanctity. The inmost one, the Dalai Lama who was given that title, and was well known as the Great 13th, made many questions concerning the probable future of Tibet. The old astrologer fumbled around in the portfolio he had with him and produced papers and charts, and together the two men pored over them. In less than 60 years, said the astrologer, Tibet as a free entity will be no more. The hereditary enemy, the Chinese, with a new form of political government will invade the country and will virtually do away with the order of priests in Tibet. At the passing of the Great 13th, the Dalai Lama was told, another would be chosen as a palliative to Chinese aggression. A child would be picked as being the reincarnation of the Great 13th, and irrespective of the accuracy of the choice, it would first and foremost be a political choice, because what would be known as the 14th Dalai Lama would come from Chinese-held territory. The inmost one was most gloomy about the whole affair, and tried to work out plans of how to save his beloved country, but, as the chief astrologer so accurately pointed out, much could be done to circumvent the bad horoscope of an individual, but there was no known way of substantially altering the horoscope and the destiny of a whole country. A country was composed of too many different units, too many individuals who could not be molded, nor commanded, nor persuaded to think along the same lines at the same time for the same purpose. So the fate of Tibet was known. The fate of the wise sayings, the holy books and the holy knowledge was not yet known, but it was thought that by suitable means a young man could be trained, given special knowledge, given special abilities, and then sent forth into the world beyond the confines of Tibet so that he could write of his knowledge and of the knowledge of Tibet. The two men continued talking, and then at last the Dalai Lama said, and this boy, The Ramper Boy, have you yet prepared the horoscope for him? I shall want you to read it at a special party at the Ramper household in 2 weeks from this day. The chief astrologer shuddered. 2 weeks?